This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 109 was recorded on March 15th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. John Malden is a veteran of financial media, and his strategic investment conference is highly respected as it brings together some of the brightest minds in finance each year. John joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll review John's outlook on equities, interest rates, and inflation, and then we'll learn what some of the most interesting ideas were that surfaced at the Strategic Investment Conference, which was held just last week in San Diego. Patrick Serezna is on vacation this week, so Kevin Muir, market strategist at East West Investment Management and author of the extremely popular Macro Tourist blog, will join me as this week's co-host. So be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview with John Malden, when Kevin and I will be back to review some of the investment themes that have been featured in recent issues of the Macro Tourist.
And I'm Kevin Muir, in for Patrick Serezna, who's taking a much-deserved week off. Eric, you told us last week that you were more likely to see 2,500 on the S&P before we saw 2,800. The market made a liar out of you and traded right up to 2,800, just ticked there for a brief moment. As of Thursday afternoon, we're looking at 2,750. What are your thoughts of the market in here?
Well, you know, the market's primary job is to make fools out of the largest number of people possible. And I remember when I heard the show last week and I said, I'm not going to see 2,800. I should have said not much above 2,800. And sure enough, that's what happened. We had some significant developments last week. Last Friday, we came up just on the 8:30 data. We came up and touched the top of the descending price channel right at about 2760. I thought that was going to hold it because I kind of thought the top was in and the top of the bounce, that is, and that we were headed down from there. I actually shorted that and got stopped out later the same day at a modest loss, which was not so pleasant. And over the next couple days, we got all the way up to, what was it, 2802, I think, that lasted for all of a minute or so before we started to head back down. Are we headed all the way back down below 2500? You know, it's going to be very interesting. I think still that's the case that I favor, is that we're headed down for a retest of the lows, at least down to the prior low, maybe a little bit lower. But, you know, as I look at this market, Kevin, we've already gone above the 61.8% Fibonacci retracement. We've broken above that descending price channel. So I'm seeing more and more signs that we could be actually moving up, let's say, to 2850 or maybe even to new all-time highs. I still think that the scenario of a retest is likely. It's less likely that you would get all the way to new all-time highs and then go back down for the retest. Usually you get part of the way up and then back down. So we'll see what happens. Is the top of the bounce in? Well, I think it is, but I thought it was last week and got stopped out trying to short it. So it certainly has been a tricky market, if nothing else. I want to ask your take, though, Kevin, on the double bottom and retest scenario. I know you've been following the show as a listener. Patrick has presented the slide deck in previous shows, kind of showing the range of where we should expect a bounce to go. Now, we're a little bit higher than the top of that range now. Do you think that means we're headed to all-time highs, or do you think it's just a little higher and we're still headed for a retest?
I'm not sure exactly, and I can't forecast with the precision of Patrick and yourself. I will tell you something. I recently did a study on Fed tightening cycles, and it was actually a Ned Davis study, and he divided up the two cycles into fast cycles and slow cycles. And what he found was that the slow cycles had an initial rise, and the stock market outperformed during the first part of it. But then later, the fast cycles, the ones where the Fed was tightening more quickly, accelerated and actually performed better towards the end of it. When I did the study and updated it, I realized that we had hit the point where the slow cycles had typically rolled over. And I'm kind of thinking that based upon this and the fact that there's no doubt that this has been a slow tightening cycle, that it might be time for the stock market to actually take a pause and maybe drift lower in the coming months. Well, anyways, on to the U.S. dollar. What do you think there?
Well, Kevin, I have a really bold call to make on the U.S. dollar. You ready, folks? Here it is. The U.S. dollar is the most important thing to get right in this macro environment, to know whether it has bottomed on February 16th and is headed higher from here, or if this is just a bounce and we're about to resume a secular downtrend. I don't know the answer, and I'd rather be honest about that, but I do have a very strong opinion that this is a critically important thing to watch. Treasury yields are the other really big important thing to watch right now. What do I see in the chart? Looks to me, frankly, like it bottomed on February 16th, and we're in a not particularly aggressive uptrend, but an uptrend just the same. We see a pattern of higher highs, higher lows, although the last low is a little bit questionable as to whether it's really a low or not, and it looks like we're moving a little bit higher this afternoon. So if I look at that, I look at what's going on in the gold market, and I look at the oil market, everything says to me dollar high. Higher. If there's anything I have learned, though, it is not to fade Juliet de Klerk's dollar calls, because she has been so accurate and so right. I remember the first time we interviewed her on the program, the dollar index, I think, was at 103, and all of our guests were dollar bullish. Juliet comes on and says, other direction, it's headed down, and I mean down big. And I thought, what is this lady talking about? Well, sure enough, 6 months later, look what happened. So I did get a chance to email Juliet this week. I said, Juliet, you still sticking to your story? Looks like dollar's edging higher. She said, not only am I sticking to my story, but I just told my subscribers that this bounce that we're seeing is a good opportunity to add to short dollar positions. And I really have a very strong respect for Juliet's views. So that gives me considerable reason to take pause before acting on what I see as a bullish pattern in the charts, but only a very mildly bullish pattern.
Eric, Juliet's always one of my favorites. What are the chances you can get her back?
You know, we just talked to her recently. We were hoping to get her back on the show in April for a feature interview. She's got a super busy month, and Patrick was working with her. I think we've got a late May date booked now. But we do have her on the schedule. It's not going to be for several more weeks. I really look forward to getting her back on the show, because her dollar calls have been fantastic. And at a time when almost everybody else is saying, hey, looks like the dollar has bottomed on February 16th, Juliet is saying it's time to add to your short position. So I'll be very curious to learn more about why she sees it that way.
I look forward to hearing from her. Let's move on to crude oil. What's your outlook there?
Well, my view continues to be that West Texas Intermediate crude should continue to move down in a downtrend toward a target between $50 and $55 in the next several weeks. And that could go much lower if there is a panic unwind of the billion barrel speculative long position that exists in both WTI and Brent oil contracts. Now, the caveats to that are this market has surprised me with considerable resilience. I think that the strength we saw in the market today on Thursday, we're looking at 61 spot 22 as we speak, just coming into the close on Thursday afternoon. That strength that we saw today was probably about options expiration and the market getting attracted to some of those option strikes. The other caveat, though, is that if Juliet is right about the U.S. dollar and that we're about to see a reversal to the downside in the dollar, that should be oil bullish, and that could throw a monkey wrench into the works. But my outlook is still oil bearish. Inventory this week coming in with crude oil building 5 million barrels. That's double analyst expectations. Needless to say, that's a very bearish sign for crude oil prices. Cushing, Oklahoma building for the first time in weeks, 338,000 barrels. Gasoline, on the other hand, drawing down a massive, and this is the reason that you're still seeing strength in these markets despite those big builds in crude oil inventory. Gasoline drawing down a massive 6.3 million barrels and another 4.4 million barrels in distillates. Production up another 12,000 barrels, so another increase in production, not as big as we've seen in previous weeks, but still consistent pattern of increasing production, and I think that those increases are going to continue and get bigger in coming weeks. Exports, approximately the same as last week, a little bit less, just under 1.5 million barrels. Keep in mind, that's about 10 million million barrels, that the crude oil build would have been larger if exports were still illegal. Market could not decide how to interpret this week's data. It was hard down and then hard up and then hard down and then up again and then much further down and then all the way down to support down around just above $60 and then way back up and then down and then up. Coming into Thursday, we got back up above $61. So the market can't decide how it wants to react to this. There is a symmetrical triangle pattern on the daily chart, which has been holding remarkably well, and we're getting very close to where the convergence point is. So the top of that triangle right now, the upper trend line, is at about 62.5 or so, while the bottom of that trend line is at about 60.5. If we take that out to the downside, which I expect that we will, you can probably see a pretty significant move after that. But that has been where support has been coming from. At this point, we need to see the market move lower. If we go above 62.50 or so, that would definitely bring question to my bearish view. But for now, I still think we're headed lower in oil prices.
I don't know about you, Eric, but I'm warming up to our little yellow friend gold. It seems to be basing around 1300. What's your feelings?
Well, I think, again, it's all about the dollar. And if Juliet's right and we are about to see the dollar tank here, then it is time to buy gold. Juliet actually, I think, recommended to her clients a few weeks ago that they get into gold at 1325. We're looking at 1316, a better entry opportunity this afternoon. You know, it's time to buy if you think that the dollar bearish view is really going to be the case. The thing is, I see so many reasons, whether it's my outlook in the oil market, you know, I see so many reasons to think that the dollar bear case, I hate to fade anything Juliet says about the dollar because I've learned the hard way to be proven wrong. But for now, I really do see a dollar bull case. So I'm still on the sidelines when it comes to gold. But certainly, if you have a view which is dollar bearish, then it's time to buy gold. It's only if you have a dollar bullish view that it's time to maybe pause. But even when I say maybe pause, I want to clarify, my long-term view is very, very much bullish on gold. Inflation is coming sooner or later. I'm not sure when, but it's coming. And at some point, owning gold is going to be the place to be. It's a very strategic long-term investment. Now, I'm in the market every single day, and I'm being a little more aggressive here and saying, I think that maybe waiting a little bit, we're going to get a better opportunity to buy it lower. But I'm not looking at shorting this market. I'm looking at the best opportunity for where to go long for a long-term investment, because I think it's going to be a fantastic trade. I just wonder if the bottom is in yet.
I know we're going to talk about this more in the post game, but I was wondering what you're feeling about 10-year treasury yields in here.
Well, Jeff Gundlach is sticking to his book, saying that we are headed towards higher treasury yields and that, you know, it's all uphill from here. I think that he may be right in terms of his secular economic call, that that's going to be the next major trend. But the thing is, and Zero Hedge had an excellent article about it this week, the speculative short positioning in 10-year Treasury futures is reaching record proportions, and that's everybody on the same side of the boat at the same time. It is a setup for a short squeeze. So even if Jeff Gundlach is right, I still think that there's room for a short squeeze that carries Treasury yields lower before they go higher. And I think that that higher secular view is probably right, but I wouldn't want to short Treasuries here. I would want to wait for this short squeeze, if it comes, to play out and see if there's not an opportunity to get better location on a short 10-year treasury trade. And you know, Kevin, what really fascinates me is Jeff Gundlach is predicting both much higher treasury yields and a much lower U.S. dollar index. Now, that's very much at odds with conventional wisdom that says as U.S. Treasury yields are increasing, that attracts international capital for the better yields, and that makes the dollar go up. So I'd love to get somebody from Double Line on the program to talk about this. We've been trying to get Jeff Gundlach ever since we started doing this podcast. He's almost as hard to get as Stephanie Pomboy. So we'll see if we can get him on the program. Meanwhile, frankly, I don't don't worry that much about the near-term trend. As I say, I think it could squeeze to lower yields before eventually moving to higher yields. What I'm much more interested in is the bigger picture question of if Gundlach is right and we're headed, as Jim Grant said, to potentially doubling the Treasury yield, and that means doubling the U.S. government's cost of borrowing. The U.S. government can't afford a doubling of its cost of borrowing. So we're headed for some really serious problems as a result of bond yields, if Gundlach is right. I don't mean next week or next month, but in coming years. And I think that that is the picture that I really want to focus on. Let's come back to that, though, in the postgame segment.
Sounds great. Thanks for the great summary, Eric. This week's feature interview guest is Maldon Economics founder and chairman, John Maldon. Eric's interview with John Maldon is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is John Maldon, founder and chairman of Maldon Economics. John, thanks so much for joining me on the program. You know, the question that seems to be on everybody's mind right now is, are we looking at the end of a relatively small market dislocation with this VIX complex blow up and so forth? Or is this actually just the beginning of something much bigger?
Well, I don't think you could characterize anything as the end. There's always things that move forward. Let's remember that there's always another recession. I don't think Trump has repealed the business cycle. He's trying to repeal the wisdom on tariffs, but he hasn't repealed the business cycle yet. And when we have a recession, we will have a 40-50% or more drawdown. So whatever bumps that we get between now and then will just be that, bumps. Now, let's remember something. The last drawdowns that we had, the corrections, if you will, were not the unusual part. They weren't the odd part. The odd part was 15 months in a row without a 2% correction. Never happened, ever, ever. So that was the odd part. That should have been what we were all looking at and going, this is scary. It wasn't a 5 or 6% correction. The type of correction we just went through was something that we normally get at least once every 12 to 18 months. You get a 5% correction every 90 days, every quarter. So that was the normal, if you will. The not normal was no corrections and just almost straight up. And we're going to see probably more corrections. We're going to see more volatility. But I would argue that any correction we see now, absent indications for a potential recession or buying opportunities, if you're a trader, you see things when they get to the top, you raise a little cash, and when they go down some, it gets in your buying such a session, you buy some and you go back in. But market drops, absent a recession, are V-shaped. When you get a recession, that's going to be ugly, and you want to be sitting somewhere on the sidelines and not involved, because the buying opportunity will come.
And what is your outlook for both recession risk as well as the equity market generally? Are you basically saying that this correction that we're going through will resolve itself to new all-time highs and will move higher? Or is there something else on the horizon?
I don't know if we go back to all-time highs, more than likely. I forget what sportscaster it was that said, the race is not always to the swift or the battle to the strong, but that's the way to bet. I think the way to bet would be that the market still wants to go up and we still are going to be looking at all-time highs. But I don't know how much higher it gets. I mean, a lot of it's going to depend on whether we really get the boost from the Trump tax cuts in the U.S. Because remember, this is by and large a U.S. market. And I would point out, we're also in a global market. And this global market that we're in is taking us to new highs. I should point out that, as many of our listeners are aware of, this is the emerging markets have done much better than the U.S. market. The U.S. market may, in fact, be getting a little long in the tooth. I think that's fair to say. I think sometime this next month, or very shortly, we become the second longest growth period in history. And it has to go for another year after that to be the longest. And it very well could. If you're looking for recession indicators, there just aren't any. I've got several of my friends who really track this stuff. I mean, they're obsessed. And one of them, he's got 18 recession indicators, and 17 of them are saying no. Another one has 11 recession indicators. By the way, they're different. I found it fascinating. And the large preponderance of those are saying no. Anyway, now these are 9 months out. One of the interesting things is there's only one really good longer-term recession indicator, and that's the inverted yield curve. And we are nowhere close to an inverted yield curve in the U.S. market. So that means when short-term rates go above long-term rates. And short-term rates have got to go up again and again and again. And the Fed is, you know, telling us they're going to do that. But that would still mean that long-term rates would have to drop an awful lot. There's no reason to think that we're going to have a recession absent something happening in Europe blowing up because of, you know, what's happening in Italy or other places, or China having some nasty, unexpected event, which I don't expect to happen. I think Xi's got the world pretty much going the way he wants it. Now, trade war, protectionism, if it gets out of hand, that could create a recession. And I am not unconcerned about that. I mean, I've said for 16, 17 years, I've been in my writing, the thing that keeps me up the most at night, the thing that really worries me about the future of our economy and our kids and everything, that's a signal for a depression, not a recession, a depression, is trade wars, protectionism, Smoot-Hawley. I mean, you get Herbert Hoover, who didn't know anything really about a lot of the things that he was coming into, not unlike maybe some people would suggest a current president is like, he's learning on the job. But Herbert Hoover let Smoot-Hawley get through, and he signed it. And it was all over for the world. We had a depression. That worries me. In and of itself, are these steel tariffs a problem? No. I mean, are some people going to lose their jobs over it because it makes their products too high? Yes. I mean, the steel company is already at record profits, for gosh sakes. I mean, it's like they don't need any help. But it's a little bitty market. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it's not that big. And by the way, under George W., he put steel tariffs in. Steel workers now, there's 160,000 of them. That's all we got left. And people say, oh, my goodness, all those jobs have left. They've gone overseas. And I say, no, they haven't. We are producing more steel today than we have ever produced. It wasn't the jobs that went to China or Mexico or whatever. It was technology. It's just silly to think that you can make those jobs come back with tariffs. 80% of the manufacturing jobs that have been lost in the United States have been lost to technology. And we've become more productive. We're producing more stuff than we've ever produced before. You go back 60, 70 years, maybe you have to go back 80. We're now producing six times more food with 10% of the people than we produced back in the 20s and 30s. Think about that. That is a marvelous production machine. And that's happening all over the world as the rest of the world is catching up with our technology. And then we wonder why food gets cheaper. We are spending half the amount of money on food. I mean, you just take a pie, you go back to 1950s and the 60s, you say, how much were families spending on food? And then how much are they spending on food today? Even with Whole Foods and all of these high priced, you know, organics things in there, we're still spending about half of what we spent just 50 years ago. The world is actually in a much better place. People are living longer. We're more educated. I'm pretty much an optimistic fellow. I'm just not all that optimistic about governments, Eric.
Well, speaking of governments, since you mentioned the inversions of yield curves and so forth, let's move on to bond yields. We're back down on the Tuesday that we're speaking to only 2.85 on the 10-year after coming pretty darn close to 3%. A lot of people think that that trend is going to continue. What do you think the driver is? Is this inflation fears? Is it something else? Why are we seeing this back up in interest rates?
Well, number one, the Fed is raising rates, and the short-term tail will wag the long-term dog a little bit. First of all, taking interest rates down to zero, taking them down to zero for as long as we did, was a mistake. Greenspan leaving rates as low as he did for as long as he did, creating a housing bubble, was a mistake. And, you know, we don't know what Jay Powell is going to do. But I think it's fair to say that they're going to try to move rates up at least three times this year. You know, the inflation numbers have come out recently. There's nothing to be alarmed about. I mean, core is still below 2%. Core PCE, which is what the Fed looks at, core PCE is way below 2%. They're reloading their ammunition for the next recession. I really do think if you look at their dot plot, they'd like to be at somewhere between 2.5% and 3% before the next recession starts. So they have some room to cut. At the rate they're going at 25 basis points every 4 months, it's going to take a long time to get to 3%.
I had Jim Grant on the program last week, and he pointed out that although it's certainly not going to happen overnight, he thinks eventually we do get back to the point where we approximately double long-term yields from here, and that would mean a doubling of the U.S. government's cost of debt service. Now, we've been at those yields before, but we had half the national debt last time we were at those yields. How far do you think the 10-year can go before something breaks, and what breaks first? Would it be the government's ability to finance itself or the stock market? Or what do you think the risk is in terms of this trend with rates?
You've asked a couple of leading questions here. First of all, let's understand the budget deficit for the United States. Everybody, all newspapers writing their headlines, is $1.2 trillion. That's a lie. That's the number that the Congressional Budget Office, Congress, and everybody puts out. We'll probably have to sell $1.7 trillion of new treasury bonds for this year. Could be a little higher or lower. There's something called the off-balance sheet debt. And there are years recently where a half a trillion is, and that's a real number, by the way. As some years it's as little as $250, $300 billion. Some years it's half a trillion. It's things like student loans and Social Security. I mean, basically both the Democrats and the Republicans got together and said, let's not count this. Let's move that into the off-budget sheet debt. I mean, just to make their budgets look better. And then Trump passes a tax cut. Republicans pass a tax cut that's worth an extra $150. Maybe I think it's going to be worth more. Not so much the first year. The first year, we're going to get a lot of income from businesses pulling money in from offshore. I think somebody told me the other day Apple pulled $300 billion in. They got to pay taxes on that. That's a one-time thing. They're not pulling that in every year, okay? This next year, our taxes may not be as bad as everybody was expecting, but the year after that, we could easily see 1.2, 1.3, 1.4, and we go into a recession. We'll be at $2 trillion a year deficits faster than you can turn. We'll be at $30 trillion. That's 150% of debt to GDP. Now, riddle me this, Batman. If Trump is facing a recession, or any Republican is facing a recession, any president is facing a recession going into his election, what are his odds of being elected? Not very good. Then you get a Democrat administration in, they're going to run on, well, we want to balance the budget. They're going to run on higher taxes, and they will give us higher taxes. What will that do? It'll put us back into a recession. All of a sudden now, by the middle of the 2020s, you're looking at $40 trillion. And my friend Jim Grant's words about, well, what's that going to cost us in terms of interest rate on the government? Just take that and double down on it. Now you're starting to talk real money. Even at 2%, $40 trillion is $800 billion. I'm sorry, $40 trillion, that's $800 billion. That's just staggering. To all of the listeners out there who are going, well, they can't pay that, I would like to tell you that you're absolutely right. That can't be paid. If something can't happen, then it won't happen. What will happen, and what I am arguing, is that we're going to all turn Japanese. The Japanese have monetized their debt. They literally have put on the balance sheet of the central bank 140% of their GDP, and they're buying every bond that they can get. The market's just not selling it to them. And you would think, well, why would the market not sell it to them? Well, they have insurance companies, they have pension companies, they have all of these institutions that are required to own Japanese debt. And they bought that Japanese debt when it was paying a little bit higher rate than it is today. And if they sold, they wouldn't have anything to buy. The Central Bank of Japan is buying indexes. They're buying ETFs. They're buying, I think it's something up there. They're up over 20% of the Japanese stock market now. I mean, if it's not nailed down, they're pushing money into the system. And you know how much inflation they have? Zero. I mean, it's almost nothing. What are their rates? Almost nothing. Eric, macroeconomics, it's turned upside down. I was talking with a former chief economist from the Federal Reserve here in Dallas, who's now teaching a class at SMU, Macro 101. I mean, it's a freshman class. I said, well, what are you going to teach him? He says, well, it's macroeconomics. I says, but what are you going to teach them? What macroeconomics, you know, textbook? And he rattled off one of the popular ones. I says, but that textbook doesn't explain Japan. It doesn't explain what's happening in Europe. How do you, none of those things that we learned last century happen anymore. And he looked at me and he says, John, we're dinosaurs. The world is upside down, Eric. And for us to be able to look at the past and say, well, we've seen this before, we know what's going to happen in the future, my answer is to you, no, you don't. We are getting ready to go into the next decade with more change, not just in macroeconomics. We're going to see more change in the next 20 years than we have seen in the last 100 combined. It's frightening. It's exhilarating. The opportunities we're going to have are going to be enormous. If you're in front of the freight train rather than on it, not so much.
Speaking of upside-down macroeconomic situations that center in Asia, we had Jim Grant tell us last week that China's banking assets have now reached the point of 40 trillion with a T dollars. It's about double the U.S. This seems to me like it could end badly. I guess my question to you is, how might it shake out? Is it just a problem that's going to be contained to China, or is there a contagion risk that this bleeds over into a deflationary wave when this all blows up that affects the rest of the world?
Well, China has been the exporter of deflation now for a long time. That's going to change a little bit. We're going to see other countries in the world begin to export deflation as their populations start working for less money. If I went into an economic crowd, into a school, into someplace where there were supposed to be educated people, And I said, how big is Indonesia? What's the population of Indonesia? Not one in 10 would come with even 100,000 of it. It's 300 million people. We don't realize how much and how many businessmen and entrepreneurs are trying to figure out how to sell stuff into the United States cheaper and better. I'm not so much worried about China having a banking asset blow up. They will just print it. Okay. Now, they're going to let some of those companies die. And they're zombies. They're zombie companies. They should be dead. 1.8 million steel workers have lost their jobs in the last 10 years. We're worried about 10 or 15,000. I mean, they've built too much capacity. They're slowly reducing their steel capacity, reducing their cement capacity. I mean, they're beginning to try to bring it down. They're trying to turn themselves into a consumer economy. I'm not terribly worried about China. I'm not a China bull, but I don't think that they're going to blow the world up. Xi Jinping has basically said, I'm going to be the dictator for the next 10 to 15 years. He's still relatively young, as Chinese leaders go. He has moved himself into the pantheon that only Mao and Deng Xiaoping held, Sun Yat-sen. And he's moving himself beyond Deng Xiaoping now, which I honestly never thought would happen. Xi Jinping is, if you pay attention, if you're a China watcher, he's impressive.
For several years now, I think people have gotten very used to the idea that deflation is the backdrop. That's the only thing you have to worry about. And I would even go so far as to say there's a whole generation of professional finance people now who have never experienced inflation in any serious way. Finally, we're seeing more and more economists come around and tell us that inflation is probably coming back. Some say sooner, some say later. Do you think that we have an inflation problem on the horizon? And if so, what are the potential consequences and knock-on effects?
Define problem. I'm serious. This is a serious question. Tell me what an inflation problem is.
Well, I guess the way I should have phrased the question is, do you see inflation on the horizon as some economists are suggesting? And if so, what will the consequences be? Is it a big problem?
Well, we have inflation right now. The number that came out today, core CPI was 1.8% year over year. That's inflation. You keep that up for about 52 years and your currency is worth half of what it was, your buying power is half what it was today. No. You keep that up for 36 years. Excuse me. My math is terrible. Do I see inflation? And I think we would all agree that inflation in the 70s was a problem. I lived through the 70s. I remember literally walking in and they would be changing prices in the grocery store while you were walking through. They'd just be putting a label over a label. I remember going to the bank and borrowing money at 19 and 20% and thinking I was lucky to get it. And by the way, I would go out and buy, because I was in the printing business at the time, I'd buy carloads, literally train carloads of paper that was going up at 30% a year. So my 20% money was making me money on the paper that I was buying. I mean, now that's inflation. That's a problem. 2% inflation, 2.5% inflation, 3% inflation, not a problem. Really, it's just not. Do I think it could get as high as 3%? Not really. As I look at the numbers, what you have to do, this gets wonkish. Inflation, they measure in a kind of a year-over-year basis for whatever reason, as opposed to 2 or 3 years. So you go back 12 months. And you have to look at what the number, the base number was back then. And what you see is that there's a lot of numbers that's making it look like there's inflation today. Those numbers are rolling off over the next 2 to 3 months. And the new numbers that are going to be the base month for 12 years going forward will not give us the same level of inflation that we're seeing today. So I'm not really expecting a inflationary moment that takes us to 5%, 6%, where the Fed would just have to slam its foot on the brake pedal. I think they can continue tapping, raising it slowly, and trying not to do anything that's going to upset the market. I mean, they're telegraphing it so far in advance. Everybody knows what's doing. It's all built into the prices. I will say this, since we're talking about the Fed, I think the one thing they are doing that is really dangerous is they are reducing their balance sheet at the same time they are raising rates. They're doing this monetary experiment with two variables, and they won't know which one was the problem. I think reducing the balance sheet's a fine thing to do, but don't do it while you're raising interest rates. On budget balance, a deficit of $1.2 trillion, off budget, $400 or $500 billion. And the Fed's going to push another $460 billion into the marketplace and saying, here, buy this stuff. We are very possibly going to have to figure out where to buy $2.2 trillion worth of bonds somewhere from somebody. And foreign governments will buy $200, maybe $250 billion. Dollar's getting weaker, which means that foreigners are going to buy more of our stuff. We're going to end up buying less because it cost us more. You want to go back to 1987, 1994? Let me give you some parallels. Dollar was getting weaker. Fed was raising rates, and they were doing it at the same time, and we had market crashes, really weak markets. So if you ask me, is there the potential for volatility? Yes, there is. I think the push by the Trump administration for a weaker dollar, this whole extraordinarily misguided attempt to reduce the trade deficit, we need to be pushing more dollars out into the world. That's what makes us the global reserve currency. They have to have those dollars to trade. We start pushing less dollars out into the world, we lose our reserve currency status. If we lose our reserve currency status, we lose the ability to fund our deficit without having serious consequences in the valuation marketplace. Japan works as a reserve currency mostly for Asia, and so they can get away with it. Europe works as a reserve currency for much of the world. They can get away with it. But if we get rid of our trade deficit, we're not a reserve currency. This is silly. We give them electrons and they give us stuff. We should be trying to figure out how to get more of that trade. Call me old-fashioned. Trade deficits are not a problem. The money comes back to us. They buy our bonds. The money comes back to us in that they invest. Our current account deficit is not a problem, and that's what we should be worried about is if that money wasn't coming back some way, if for some reason that wasn't in control, then we should worry, but we don't need to be worried about that.
John, your firm, Malden Economics, is very well known, among other things, as the producer of the Strategic Investment Conference in San Diego, which just occurred last week. It's the event of the season for a lot of people. Tell us a little bit about the past event, just happened last week. What did you learn there? What were the surprises from the various speakers and attendees that you learned from the conference?
I think the biggest surprise was two of the biggest macro traders that I know. I mean, guys that have made their living and really good living being macro traders, shifting their business and saying, we're moving into completely different styles. We're becoming country focused. We're becoming very rifle shot focused. And oh, by the way, we are going to get heavily involved in blockchain and cryptocurrencies. And it was kind of like if you woke up and General Motors says, we're going to stop producing cars and we're going to go compete with Amazon. It was a surprise to me, but I got into some side rooms and I started talking. I said, guys, what are you doing? I mean, these are friends of mine. I go to their homes. I go into their offices. And these were shifts in the last 2 or 3 months. And they are shifting their entire staffs and business. And one of them, John Burbank, said, John, there's a regime change coming in the world. What I was doing is no longer working. And I think this is where the value propositions are. I mean, he has one country that he's launching a fund. You're looking at it and you're going, that's the last country that you should be looking at. And he lays it out and you go, oh, I want in that fund. And I really am. I'm going to give him money. And because number one, the guy's just a brilliant thinker, but he says, John, if you see something that's glaring and bright, you stop doing what you were doing, even if it was successful, even if you're making money, you walk away from it and you now think and you devote all of your management and effort time to where the world is going, not on where it's been. And so many businesses, think Blockbuster, think Kodak, think whatever, focused on protecting what they had and not saying, where do we go? What's happening? How do we change and move with the times? You know, they become legendary for failing. And we all know that, but to actually do it and to see more than one, I mean, there were several people at the conference that were saying, yeah, we're changing. We're moving on. That was a surprise. I was surprised at the preponderance of some of the best macro thinkers in the world thinking that we're going to have a recession by 2020, 2019, many of them were saying. I knew some of them would be. I just didn't think there would be that many of them. The panel that we did on Thursday night with the Democratic pollster, Pat Caddell, Neil Howe, who's the expert on generations and the millennials and wrote The Fourth Turning, one of the most brilliant intellectuals in America, Steve Moore and myself, where we were talking about what's going to happen in 2020. Where's politics going? This was a pure political panel. It ran long. It ran 90 minutes. I looked at the audience as we've been at it 90 minutes. It was 9 o'clock. I'm going to start wrapping it up. And I actually, Eric, I was booed for the first time in 15 years. There was clear discontent. And I said, okay, how many of you want to keep going? 95% of the hands in the room went up and they stayed. And when I finally closed it down, because it was 9:35, there were people that crowded the front. They wanted to go on. And because what we were talking about was how things will change. And for decades, politics have been kind of irrelevant to economics. The market grows, businesses grow, we move forward. Geopolitics is going to become central over the next 10, 12 years. We talked a lot about technology. We talked about markets. I mean, David Rosenberg, with all humility, there's not a better economic conference in the country, anywhere, because most economic conferences, and I had so many veterans come up to me of economic conferences. I had one guy sit down, he says, I've been to 40 of these. You go there and you exhibit or you do whatever, and they have two keynote speakers and the rest are people who pay to get on the stage. He says, you have nothing but keynotes. Nobody pays to get on my stage, which is why you would think, looking at the prices we charge, we actually make a lot of money for this conference. We actually don't, because my speaker budget would choke a horse. I bring people on that I want to hear, that people want to hear, they have something to say. So it's nothing but the fire hose giving you information. And believe it or not, most of the attendees, we give them a reduced rate. We have something called a virtual pass, where you can get all of the videos, audio if you want it, and a transcript, slides and all their decks, and it's all there. And so you go to MaldenEconomics.com, just Google John Malden, you'll get to Malden Economics, and on our front page will be some place to buy the virtual pass for the Strategic Investment Conference. And you can scan through it, you can look through it at your leisure, you can get the transcripts. Honest to goodness, this was, as everybody told me going out, and we have people that have been coming to this conference for 7, 8, 10 years. I mean, that's the highest compliments you can get for a conference, when people come back again and again and again. So I would recommend you get the virtual pass. And by the way, if you're listening to this and you don't read my letters, my letter is free every week. Just go to Malden Economics, Google John Malden, stick your email address in, and you're one of my 1 million closest friends.
Well, John, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Definitely for our listeners, I recommend you look first at Thoughts from the Frontline is the free newsletter. You can sign up for Malden Economics, and while you're there, check out those virtual passes for the Strategic Economic Conference. Kevin Muir and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, great interview with John, but you piqued my curiosity with that comment about John not having invited you to speak at the Strategic Investment Conference yet. Were you serious about that? And if you were invited, what topic or topics would you speak about?
Yeah, actually, I am serious. And John and I had a good conversation off the air after the interview. And it seems like there's some opportunity there. And the Strategic Investment Conference is definitely one of the better ones for anyone who doesn't know how things work in this field. It's kind of backwards from the rest of the world. You know, I used to do a lot of public speaking in the computer industry. And the conferences and events that we had, the people that were speaking knew something. And the way it works in the finance industry is mostly this pay-to-play business model, where, as John described in the interview, you'll have one or two keynote speakers that people actually want to hear speak, and then everybody else are basically salesmen who purchased the speaking slot for money in order to get a chance to have some airtime in front of the audience. And John's event is one of very few in the finance industry that actually is all speakers that people want to hear, not people who just bought their way into it. So it's a good conference. I'd love to speak at it. As far as topics, two things, really. One is the peak cheap oil story, which so many people don't understand. It's not peak oil, it's peak cheap oil. And you know, basically, a lot of people think that peak oil was disproven in the late 2000s. That's really not true. What was disproven is a lot of foolish people who misinterpreted the science of peak oil and thought it meant that oil prices could only go straight up, which of course is not true. So it's a discussion of peak oil production, peak oil demand, what we can expect in the long term in terms of the outlook for oil markets and so forth. And the other one is this topic that actually I think we finally... So many of our listeners have asked me to do a debate about Bitcoin with a Bitcoin expert, and I really don't want to do a debate. I'd rather do a respectful discourse with someone who, you know, comes to different conclusions, but not trying to prove the other guy wrong, rather just comparing notes with another professional. We don't want to do that on Macro Voices because I think for the sake of neutral turf, it would be better to do it someplace else. So I'm talking to another prominent podcast host about setting that up with a Bitcoin expert. But the presentation that I talked to John about off the air was really going a little bit deeper into distributed ledger technology, what the outlook is for distributed ledgers. And that's the blockchain part of things as opposed to the Bitcoin cryptocurrency. The actual blockchain distributed ledger is not a particularly good one. It's one of the biggest criticisms I have of Bitcoin. But there are other distributed ledgers coming onto the market that I really think are going to change the world for the better. So it'll be a discussion essentially about blockchain technology, to use that term very broadly to include other things. What's wrong with the proof of work model that Bitcoin is based on? Why this whole idea of mining is a bad idea and so forth. So we talked about doing that, but you know, it's funny. I get a lot of emails from listeners, Kevin, saying, why don't you speak at the Casey conference? Why don't you speak at the Sprott conference in Vancouver? It's not up to me. If you want me to speak at these things, you got to tell the people at Casey and the people at Sprott, Rick Rule and company, that set up that conference in Vancouver. I'd love to speak at that one. I'd love to speak at John's Strategic Investment Conference. So if any of you who are considering buying virtual passes, if you're buying a virtual pass to see this last Strategic Investment Conference, please let them know if you want me as a speaker at the next one, because it is the paying customers whose opinion counts. Me telling them that I should speak at their conference doesn't really carry a whole lot of weight.
And for those listeners who aren't aware, Eric wrote a terrific white paper that is linked in this week's research roundup. Eric, why don't you tell us what that's about?
Well, Kevin, the white paper basically describes the reasons that I think blockchain, which is the distributed ledger protocol that underlies the Bitcoin cryptocurrency, was a really, really important innovation. And I liken it to the Wright Flyer. It changed history because for the first time we have the ability to store information in a computer system where nobody is the central authority that owns it. And that means that nobody can hack it. It has profound, profound implications to the future of information technology. As a former IT and distributed systems guy, I really dig it. It's awesome. But look, the first version of anything, take the Wright Flyer. You go to the airport today, you don't see Wright Flyers out on the tarmac. The reason is technology's come a long way since then. We've got better airplanes from Boeing and McDonnell Douglas and so forth. So the analogy is blockchain is like the Wright Flyer. It's a great idea. It's going to change the world. But blockchain itself is only suitable as a prototype. And the things that are wrong with it primarily are this idea of mining and the proof of work algorithm, which is how they make sure that the bad guys don't outnumber the good guys in the network. They did it in a way which is incredibly wasteful of resources, and it was perfectly suitable for a prototype. It proves a concept, it's great, but to use it as the basis of a global payment system is crazy. So the white paper basically explains why I don't think there is a future for the current Bitcoin blockchain, although I think there's a very big and important future for distributed ledger technologies as they advance beyond this foolish idea of mining and proof of work into a more robust technical architecture. The other side of what's in the white paper is I talk about cryptocurrencies and why the libertarian-inspired features of Bitcoin are more likely to get it outlawed than to make it successful, and why I think government-backed digital currencies, which have exact opposite characteristics, are likely, unfortunately, to dominate. And I'd love to be proven wrong on that, but I just make the case for why, unfortunately, I don't think it's going to go the way the Bitcoin crowd hopes that it will. In any case, Kevin, I don't want to spend our time today talking about my stuff. I want to focus on the fantastic chart book that you sent us. Listeners, please refer to your research roundup email where you'll find a download link to our post-game chart book. The title of the presentation is How Did We Get Here? By Kevin Muir. It may say just post-game chart book, I'm not sure, but it's a fairly lengthy chart book. A lot of the beginning of it covers topics which our long-term Macro Voices listeners are already well familiar with, why we have a 35-year bond bull market and why it may be reversing and so forth. We went ahead and included this full chart book, which Kevin has used in other presentations, for the benefit of any newer listeners who may not be familiar with these topics. But Kevin, what I'd like to do is fast forward right to page 24 in this excellent presentation, because when I talked in the market wrap earlier about why I think that even though Jeff Gundlach may be right about a secular trend towards higher interest rates, if anything, I think speculative positioning right now sets us up for a short squeeze, a move in the other direction toward lower yields. I couldn't possibly have asked for a better picture than you have here on page 24 to illustrate this. You're showing how there was a huge amount of speculative short interest towards the end of 2016. So as I visualize this, what I see on this chart is, first of all, we went from fairly small exposures a couple of years ago to really big exposure in the last year. What that says to me, in either direction, short or long, that says to me that the market has figured out that the really big, important issue to focus on right now is, in fact, Treasury yields, which way they're headed, because that trend is going to be so important. And you can see here that big speculative short positioning at the end of 2016 reversing to a speculative long positioning. If you want to know how we got from the first time we hit 260 on the 10-year all the way down to 2-spot 10, it was that change in sentiment. Of course, Jeff Gundlach is extremely prominent in the industry. Later in 2017, he persuaded just about everybody of his view that Treasury yields are headed higher. And sure enough, he's changed their mind. Look at that swing from the green area in the middle of 2017 that shows a record speculative long interest in 10-year Treasury futures reversing to the downside. And now we've got a near record speculative short interest. Kevin, I want to get your view on this, because something Jim Rogers taught me is when everybody is on one side of the boat, even if they're right, if everybody's on one side of the boat, it's such a setup for a short squeeze. So would you concur that this is basically a picture that says, watch out for a short squeeze? And if so, how far do you see it going? And what's your outlook in terms of treasury yields from here?
I completely agree, Eric. And it's just another example of how bipolar the markets have become. Like, if you look at that, when Trump was first elected, everyone got all bullish on the economy. The specs leaned hard on the 10-year and got it all short. And then within kind of months, they went from record short to record long, and now back to record short. So it's just a function of these markets being so difficult to navigate from that function in terms of the how quickly sentiment changes and flips around. But there's no doubt that right now we're sitting in an environment where everybody is short. You turn around and all people can talk about synchronized global growth and the fact that the Trump tax cuts are going to be so strong for the economy. And everyone has the same view, which is basically that everything is rosy and that the economy is going to keep growing and that the Fed is going to keep raising rates. That's going to end up with rates being much higher. And when everyone feels one way, you know that it's time to start looking to go the other way.
Well, and you know, the thing that I see on this chart too is look at the trend from a few years ago. The magnitude of these speculative positions is getting bigger in both directions. So if we're correct, and this is a setup for a short squeeze, Zero Hedge had an article this week too saying essentially the same thing, that this is a setup. Even if Gundlach is right, that the big picture is really going to be about a secular shift toward higher rates. What I see here is, boy, it's such a setup, Kevin. If we go back into the green side here and everybody says, uh-oh, Gundlach was wrong. You know, it's the herd mentality, Kevin, that I see potentially on the horizon, where if this reverses, maybe you go even bigger to a longer long, to a greater net long exposure that takes us all the way down to 2%, surprising everybody. Then everybody gets it cemented into their head that, okay, Gundlach was wrong, Raul Paul was right, we're headed towards 50 basis points, and it turns around and goes the other way to 3.5% or something. It seems to me if you get to the end of a 35-year market in anything, the number of people that are going to be trying to speculate on that and decide whether it's really over or not is going to increase as more and more people see this as a key issue. So I think it's going to be just really telling to see, number one, does a short squeeze develop? We don't know that it will. Jeff Gundlach could be right, and we could be headed straight to 3.5% from here. But if it does, how far does it go? And do we potentially get another overshoot in the other direction?
Well, I completely agree. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see that the euro dollar, the 3-month euro dollars futures, which are not futures on currency, but instead a future based upon the LIBOR rate, which is overseas US dollars. It's basically the rate at which banks lend to one another. And you've had that great series with Jeff Snyder that's explained it all, Euro Dollar University. But if you go look at the net spec position on slide 25, you'll see that the specs are short almost $4 trillion of 3-month euro dollar futures. So what that means is that even more so than the long rates, speculators are expecting the Fed to raise rates at the short end. And that goes to the fact that everyone thinks that the Trump tax cuts are going to be so stimulative, that the growth is going to come in the U.S., and that the U.S. is going to continue to outperform. And I think that there's a good chance that basically all the good news for the U.S. economy is already baked in. And even if the economy continues to post good numbers, they're not going to be good enough for the market. And that what's going to happen is we're actually going to get a squeeze. And the squeeze will be at the front end of the curve, I think. So what that'll mean is that the front end will go from pricing in 3 or 4 Fed hikes to 2. It's not going to take much in terms of economic news that disappoints to basically very quickly take 4 hikes and turn it into 2, 1, or even none. And if that happens, then what will happen is that the front end of the curve will rally like you've never seen before as this record short struggles to try to get that position back in.
You know, the thing I see in this, which I think is very consistent with what you've just said, is everybody's focused right now on, oh, it's going to be more and more hikes. The Fed is hiking, hiking, hiking. Well, why is the Fed hiking? I think the Fed is hiking because they're trying to store some bullets up so they're able to accommodate the next time we get into trouble and we have a recession. Now, it may be that there's lots of hikes coming in the immediate future, but the reason that they're doing this hiking is so that they can ease. And, you know, we don't know when that's going to be necessary, but we know it's coming someday. And I don't think the market has its eye on the fact that the reason for the hikes is to give us room to go the other direction when we need to.
The other thing is, if you go to slide 27, you'll notice that the world economies have already rolled over. This is a chart of the Citibank Echo Surprise Index. It's basically the difference between expectations and what the economic numbers are actually released at. So when the economic numbers are coming in above consensus, this index is rising. And when they're coming in below consensus, it's declining. Well, if you'll notice, this index actually topped in December or early January and has been slumping really hard since. So I think that a lot of bond traders and investors haven't realized that the economy is already rolling over.
You know, Kevin, on page 28, you're speaking so directly to the core of my view longer term in this market, which is you say here that the real bond bear market will come when central banks are not able to raise interest rates due to debt burdens. And I could not agree with you more. We are headed, I think, very clearly towards a scenario, and I think maybe the short squeeze happens first and we get a head fake in the other direction, but we are headed higher in yields, and those higher yields are eventually going to get us to the point, as Jim Grant told us last week, where you could see a doubling of the U.S. government's debt service cost. The U.S. government cannot afford a doubling of its debt service cost. We would be at the point where most of tax revenues are going just to debt service. I want you to talk us through the mechanisms of this, because if at first glance, if you don't understand the interaction with inflation, you'd say, well, wait a minute, you're saying that the bond bear market would come when central banks are not able to raise rates. Well, raising rates usually pushes prices down. So why would a bear market come when they're not pushing prices down? Explain the interplay that exists there between the short and long end of the curve and how inflation plays into this.
Well, if you think about a long bond investor's worst nightmare, apart from default, and let's just put that aside for a second, assuming we're investing in sovereigns, the worst thing that could happen to a long bond investor is inflation. It erodes the purchasing power of your bond and you're earning a fixed coupon. And meanwhile, inflation is making your money that you're going to receive later worth less. So the worst thing that can happen for a long bond investor is to have a central bank that is too easy, because ultimately what will happen is that you'll get more inflation and it'll erode the value of your bond. So when the Fed goes and raises rates, thereby keeping inflation in control, it's actually very beneficial to the long end of the curve. And that is why you get a flattening of the curve, meaning that the Fed raises the short end. So the twos or the fives, the yield goes up. But the long end says, whoa, you know what? The Fed's going to keep inflation in check. So therefore, I can own long bonds because I know this is not going to go above 2% and go to 3 or 4. So therefore, I can own a 10 or 20 or 30 year bond and be confident that the inflation will be held in check. What I envision is that eventually the Fed will let inflation run hotter. And whether that's because of populism or whether it's because they simply can't afford it in terms of the debt burden is too high and raising rates in the short end would cause too much pain from a fiscal point of view, it doesn't really matter. But it's at that point that the true bond bear market will happen, because what in essence will be occurring is that the Fed will be keeping rates too low, thereby creating inflation, which is the long bond investor's worst nightmare.
You know, Kevin, as you were speaking, I couldn't help but think of the movie The Perfect Storm. And the whole idea there was this horrible storm, but there was actually three storms. And it was when the three storms met together that they all compounded each other. If I listen to everything that you just said, and I think about how long it would take for that to play out, where we get to the point where the Fed cannot really raise interest rates very much because of what it would do to the U.S. government's cost of borrowing, I think, well, what's the time frame that happens in? What else would be happening around the world in that same time frame? Well, let's see. You've got China pushing this petro-yuan contract, trying to move oil trade away from the dollar. You've got the whole Russia, Sergei Glazyev effort, de-dollarization, pushing people to move away from U.S. treasuries as reserve assets. If you had these other trends come together with everything you just described, you want to talk about a bloodbath in the U.S. treasury market. It would be when you had everything you described happen, compounded by a sudden lack of interest on the part of international buyers who no longer want to buy U.S. treasuries because they've discovered that there are better alternatives around the world and the U.S. treasury is no longer perceived globally as the safest reserve asset on earth. It seems to me like, you know, things are lined up pretty well for those two storms to come together in the next couple of years here. Am I crazy to think that?
No, not at all. I would say that you're probably a little more bearish on the U.S. bond market specifically than I am. I look at all sovereigns. You look at Japan, you look at Europe, Italy. There's tons of sovereigns out there with the same balance sheet. So I actually think that it could be a global phenomenon that actually occurs everywhere and that all central banks are keeping rates stuck at the front end of the curve, very low, and then the long end just they lose control of it.
Kevin, something you've written about recently is you actually see this potentially getting bad enough that maybe you could even see a corporate sovereign inversion from the norm where you see lower yields on corporates than on sovereign debt. How is that even possible?
Well, if you think back to kind of 10 years ago before the great financial crisis, if I had told you that there was going to be negative rates, you would have laughed. If I would have told you that swap spreads, which are a bank credit versus sovereigns, would trade negative, you would have told me there was no way it would happen. Well, I was thinking back and I was remembering a book I read, Inside the House of Money by Steve Drobny. And in it, there was a trader by the name of Jim Leitner. And at the time, he was short euro dollar futures. And he wanted to hedge because he was worried about the possibility of the euro dollars trading above 100. And everyone laughed at him and told him that was insane. And they gladly sold him the call options that theoretically could never happen. Well, if you go look at the European equivalent of euro dollar futures, they're trading above 100 now. So I kind of laugh and say it was my Jim Leitner moment. And what it was I thought about it. And I thought about the fact that sovereigns are issuing all this debt, but they're also the ones that make the rules. So we're giving the sovereigns the money and assuming that they're going to keep the rules the same. And if you think about what's going to happen as these debt burdens increase and increase and increase, there'll be more of a chance that sovereigns simply say, we're going to extend this or we're going to default. Now, you might argue that they're going to default through inflation, and that very well could be. But there's also lots of sovereigns throughout the centuries that have defaulted outright. And in one of my posts, I actually go through and show them all. It's actually surprising how many sovereign defaults there have been over time. So we've been kind of going through 10 or 20 years where we haven't had very many of these. But as the debt burdens increase of these sovereigns, it increases the chance that they're going to default. Now, even if they don't default, the simple fact that they have the potential could worry investors. And if you're a long-term endowment that's thinking about where to put your money, and you're faced with Italy that's got a huge debt burden that you're worried that they're going to default or do something, and then you're faced with a company, a big, large, multinational Italian company with real estate and a AAA rating, I could see a situation where you would say, you know what, the security held by that AAA company is enforceable by a third party, the government, and I know the rules can't change. So therefore, it actually behooves me to go buy the corporate where I know that the rules, I can count on the rules being the same because the government's not going to go and allow the corporate to default. But they will maybe do it for themselves, but they're not going to change the rules against the corporate. So if you actually look at the balance sheets of sovereigns versus some of these AAA corporates and think about history, you might make more sense to own the corporates.
It's interesting that you mentioned that. One of the things that's in the talk for the Strategic Investment Conference after I get the invitation is how you could use distributed ledger technology to build a sovereign bond market where the rules are enforced and the governments issuing them can't change them. But I want to come back to what you said just now because I totally get how an emerging market country that is unable to borrow in its own currency could have a sovereign default. I understand that. I also understand how a European country such as Italy could have a sovereign default because the individual countries in the Eurozone don't have the ability to turn on the printing press and make more euros. But how could anybody ever think that there is a greater default risk on U.S. treasuries when the U.S. Treasury has the ability to print more money to monetize the debt with? How could they ever think that that risk exists? And in this analysis that you've done, are there examples of sovereign defaults by countries that had borrowed in their own currency and had the ability to monetize but didn't for some reason?
Eric, I completely agree that the chances of the U.S. defaulting is very, very low. But you do have to realize that Trump has already threatened China with a strategic default. He doesn't actually have to default for the corporate spreads to trade through U.S. Even the threat of default might cause those spreads to move. But really what I was more thinking about was in Europe and other countries like that. With countries that like Japan and the U.S. that are able to go and print their currency, chances are they're just going to print their way out of it. But with Europe, there's a very good chance that countries like Italy that aren't able to print their way out run into some real serious trouble. And the other interesting thing about Europe is that if you look at how the ECB is planning on tapering, they're going to taper by curtailing their purchases of sovereigns, but they're not going to curtail their purchases of corporates. So we could get a situation where the Bund and all these other sovereigns back up in yield, sell off, but the ECB, Mario Draghi and company are still there bidding for corporates. And if that happens, even if it doesn't make any sense, you could have corporates trading through sovereigns.
Well, Kevin, in the interest of time, we're going to have to leave it there. Before we go, please tell our listeners where they can sign up for the free Macro Tourist blog. It's one of the best on the net and is extremely popular.
Well, thank you, Eric. You can go to themacrotourist.com and there's a sign up button there. It's free. It's delivered every day. I try to make it fun and interesting for everyone to read. And the other thing is you can follow me on Twitter at Kevin Muir, M-U-I-R.
Well, Kevin, thanks so much for filling in for Patrick as this week's co-host. We really appreciate it. Patrick will be back next week. Meanwhile, folks, we need your help promoting the program. So please retweet our announcements, forward your research roundup emails to your friends and colleagues. And most importantly, if you haven't done it yet, go to macrovoices.com and register your free account. The benefit to you is that you'll receive our research roundup email, which never contains any marketing or advertising. It's just a compendium of links to all of the coolest content that we could find on the internet each week, including presentations that support our feature interview guests, as well as articles and other fascinating content that our volunteer research team was able to find on the internet each week. Costs you nothing, and the more registered listeners that we have, the more able Patrick Ceresna is to negotiate to get the very best feature interview guests. We've got a great one coming up next week. Patrick will be back as well. I can't remember all the rest of the stuff he says to close the show, so we're going to leave it there.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.